It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up, we'll get some ideas on what to do with all those Thanksgiving leftovers in the fridge. But first, today is Black Friday, the day often called the biggest shopping day of the year. Our next guest wants people to skip the shopping spree and stay home with their families instead. He thinks it's good for your wallet and the planet. Dave Gardner joins us now. He's the founder of Growth Busters, an anti-consumption organization, and the director of the film Hooked on Growth. Dave, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
So as I said, it's Black Friday, big shopping day. Why would you prefer that people maybe sit it out?
Well, it's pretty clear that Black Friday has become a monument to overconsumption, where we are enticed to be not human beings, but to be consumers and embrace our consumerhood, go out and, even if necessary, go into debt in order to get things that we really don't need. And it's on a planet where we're already consuming at such a rate that we're liquidating the planet of the resources that our children are going to need in order to have a healthy economy. So it's symbolic largely because it symbolizes destroying our kids' chance to have jobs and have a good economy in order to prop up an unsustainable economy.
Well, that cuts, I think, to the core of what Growth Busters is working on and what you talk about in the documentary. We have gotten used to thinking of an economy as always growing and as economic growth, as GDP growth, as a positive, no doubt about it. Is that wrong? Is that a wrong way to view the economy?
Well, that's definitely the crux of the documentary Growth Busters Hooked on Growth. I found when I researched the film that that we got off track. About over the last 50 or 60 years, we allowed the definition of the good life to get hijacked. It used to mean something that was really meaningful to you when you were evaluating your life on your deathbed, and that didn't mean, wow, how many cars you had or how many trophy houses you had, that kind of thing. But also we fell in love with GDP growth because we saw that GDP growth happened concurrently with a lot of great improvements during the last 100 years. You know, indoor plumbing, who would argue with that? We love having indoor plumbing. We love being able to fly across the country to visit relatives on a holiday. But we got off track on that too, and you can't grow economic throughput forever. So here we are on a planet with over 7 billion people, and we still insist on having more economic throughput and more people year after year after year. And we're really injuring the ecosystems that provide our life support.
One argument against this kind of argument over the years is that as our consumption increases, so does our technology, our ability to produce more stuff. Science and technology keep running out ahead of our consumption. So what's the problem?
Well, technology's had kind of, actually, when you look at it, a mixed track record. Certainly there have been some gains. Technology has allowed us to fix some of the problems we've created. But frequently, technology, when it fixes one problem, it creates a new one. And sometimes it takes us a few years to figure that out. You know, technology brought us DDT, malathion, CFCs, and a number of things that we ended up later having to work very hard to get out of the system. And largely, a lot of the gains that technology has allowed us to make really kind of, you could credit fossil fuels for really solving a lot of the problems, like the Green Revolution, the fact that we have been able to feed a lot more people on the planet than we thought we could 100 years ago. But we're bumping up against the limits today. There are 1 billion people going to bed hungry every night. Technology isn't fixing that.
And another problem, speaking of the population of the world, that you're worried about is population growth.
Absolutely, because our impact on the planet is a product of how many of us there are and our economic throughput. So, you know, if we have a lot of people having economic throughput, that just changes things. You know, you can have a few people with a lot of economic throughput, or you can have a lot of people living simpler lives. And, you know, the truth is we're so far into what the scientists call overshoot, where we really are liquidating the planet of resources faster than the planet can replenish them. We've actually got to work on both of those. We need to stabilize and then start slowly reducing our population, which we can do very elegantly and voluntarily. And we need to kind of just get rid of this idea that that we have to go shopping, that somehow that's our patriotic duty and that good comes from that. And, you know, I'm not arguing against this holiday gift-giving tradition. People can find ways to honor that gift-giving tradition without going to the mall and buying something that is maybe isn't needed. I'm advocating really thoughtful shopping, where you really think about the carbon footprint of the product you buy. And is there another way you can show family members that you love them, maybe with the gift of your time? Cook them a meal. Give them a certificate for a massage or a certificate that they can redeem for your time helping them around the house, something like that. There are a lot of ways to give that. Not only are they lighter on the planet, but it turns out that they really mean a lot more to the people that get them.
It's a lot to ask for a place like the United States to recalibrate its ideas of wanting more things, wanting growth, wanting gifts around the holidays on the one hand. And then there's a developing world that's maybe has the aspiration to be like us in that way. How do you think this message will get spread?
Well, I mean, it's one of the reasons. It really is a complicated thing. It's hard to wrap your hands around it. And that's one reason why we're actually showing the documentary Growth Busters Hooked on Growth on the Internet tonight, free, around the world. We're encouraging people to stay away from the mall, pop some popcorn, play games with your family, and then watch this film, and it'll really provide some stimulating conversation, I guarantee, afterward. The people in the rich world, we can actually improve our lives if we step off the treadmill that we are on in service to this growth-obsessed economy. And that might leave a little bit of room on the planet for people who have a lot less to improve their status. And that might involve some economic growth, although I really want to caution people not to use economic growth as the goal, but rather let's redefine what a healthy economy is, and let's try to find ways for everyone to have meaningful work and a healthy economy.
On a personal level, you mentioned earlier that our idea of the good life and what is a good life has changed. If we change it from stuff and having things, what is a good life?
Well, I think for most of us, it really comes naturally. One of the gentlemen interviewed in my film, Mike Nickerson, a brilliant Canadian, says we have lots of room for more of a few things. And the three L's are his favorite: learning, loving, and laughing. And that's a cliche. No one ever on their deathbed wished they spent more time at the office, but it's a really valuable cliche. What do you think you would wish you had spent more time doing when you're on your deathbed? I'll bet you wish you had known your kids better. You had spent more time with your parents or your spouse, you know, that you had maybe spent more time just sitting on the porch reading a book or watching the clouds roll by. Those things, it turns out, really make us a lot happier. All the studies show that just accumulating more stuff does not make us happier.
As a lot of us are hitting the stores today on Black Friday, do you, outside of your documentary, see a reaction brewing? A lot of people thinking along the lines that you are?
I'm really even pleasantly surprised at how quickly this is catching on. I think this year, Buy Nothing Day, which was started by Adbusters back in 1992, is really being talked about a lot more. And supposedly a pretty small percentage of people are at least admitting that they're planning to shop today. I do see that there's already some incidents of violence happening. People are still being pretty crazy out there. But I think we're starting to show signs that we're getting it. And I think even the economy, the recession that for many people is still underway is in some ways is forcing us to do that. We can't afford to go over shop and over consume. And in a way, that's a good thing because it forces us to be a little more thoughtful about how we honor the holiday traditions.
Dave, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Hey, it's been my pleasure. I hope people will check out growthbusters.org so they can watch the movie with us tonight.
That's Dave Gardner. He's a film director and an advocate for sustainability. He's the director of Hooked on Growth. That's the documentary he was just mentioning, the founder of the group Growthbusters. Coming up, it's Food Friday. Our guest has some tips about what to do with our Thanksgiving leftovers. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time. It's Food Friday, and we've got some timely advice for you today if you're sitting on a mountain of Thanksgiving leftovers. Patricia Mulvey is here. She's founder and chef at Local Time, THYME, a CSA menu planning service, and lead contributor to Farm Fresh and Fast. And she tells me she is the queen of Thanksgiving leftovers. Patricia, welcome back to the show.
Thanks. That's a self-anointed title.
I will not challenge the title. Do you cook on Thanksgiving with the plan, the intention of having leftovers to work with?
I absolutely do. I begin cooking the weekend before because I make my own homemade stock to make my gravy. And I go way out of my way to make an enormous amount of gravy because two of my favorite leftovers are based on the gravy.
Let's start there. Great. Okay. What do we do with that leftover? I love gravy. I mean, I don't drink it, but I'll eat it on any of those Thanksgiving things. What do we do with our leftover gravy?
My two favorite meals with my leftover gravy, one we will be having tonight, is biscuits and gravy.
Wow.
Make a homemade buttermilk biscuit, warm up your gravy with some pieces of turkey in it, and there's a simple leftover dinner, and then just warm up some of your leftover veggies with that.
Okay, that's pretty straightforward. And you said there were two favorites,
yes.
I think.
Yes. My second one is my daughter, Quinny's favorite leftover, mm-hmm. which is pot pie.
Oh, yeah.
And that's a great way to use up all manner of random vegetables and of course, your turkey and your gravy. So take your, if you made some Alsem sweet corn and maybe some roasted squash or some glazed carrots, and just do them in with your gravy, add in some more chopped turkey, and roll out a pie dough and bake it. Simple.
Well, that makes all the sense in the world. I mean, pot pie, you can put just about anything in it. It's a disposal service in a lot of ways.
Yeah, okay. Absolutely.
Oh, well, and you mentioned the turkey in the pot pie, of course. And that's probably, you hear on Friday or Saturday, people being sick of the turkey. What are some ways to get, you know, a little innovative, a little different with the leftover turkey?
Well, there's all kinds of fantastic sandwiches that are not your typical throw on your cranberry sauce, put, you know, a piece of turkey between two pieces of bread. Mm-hmm. We made turkey banh mi sandwiches the last 2 years.
Turkey what?
Banh mi. It's a Vietnamese-style sandwich. It takes French bread, baguettes, mm-hmm. And then it's made usually with a pâté. My husband actually did 1 year take the turkey and make a pâté out of it, but you can just do it with sliced turkey and make it easier. It's got pickled daikon radish and carrots. It's got cilantro. It's got serrano peppers, if you like it spicy, and I do like it spicy. And so then I also add sriracha mayonnaise.
Wow.
So that's not your typical turkey sandwich.
Yeah, so that is going to be a nice change of pace if you're tired of the turkey. And nice and zippy there, it sounds like. Sriracha mayonnaise, is that you make your own?
Yeah, you just take a dollop of mayonnaise and squeeze how much sriracha you want into it.
Oh, okay. So, yeah, that's not too hard to do.
No, it's easy.
And I think you mentioned before you came in, vegetarians.
Yeah.
Vegetarians obviously don't eat the turkey necessarily.
That's
you
right.
have a favorite vegetarian option and ideas for what to do with the leftovers.
Yes. Yeah, so I do have a segment of the family that is vegetarian. And when they come to visit, we always make roasted vegetable risotto of some sort, usually a roasted squash risotto. And the best use of a risotto for a leftover is a nice Italian dish called arancini. And it's when you take your risotto and you scoop it into a little ball and you put a little surprise in the middle of it, a piece of cheese or a piece of roasted pepper, and you roll up that ball in breadcrumbs and then you deep fry it. It's delicious.
So deep fried risotto with cheese and breadcrumbs in the middle.
Uh-huh.
Wow.
Uh-huh.
Okay, that sounds
really
good in Wisconsin-y too, the deep frying part of it. That's great. My favorite, the best thing I ever did with leftover turkey, I think, was 1 year I made turkey enchiladas with it.
That's
and enchiladas I love because they're easy. It's just assembly. It's not really cooking, but it looks like you put a lot of work into it. So I just rolled it up with, you know, our refried beans and cheese and then soak it in sour cream and salsa and bake it for a while.
That's perfect.
Any other ethnic permutations? You've had Vietnamese so far and Italian. And
yes.
I've got a little Mexican, I guess, with the enchiladas. Any other ethnic ideas for turkey?
Sure. I mean, obviously, one of the things everybody likes to do with their leftover turkey is make some kind of soup. And you can make all kinds of different soups. One would be a Greek-style avgo limono soup, where you make your basic stock, put in some vegetables, put in your turkey meat, but then you temper the eggs. You whisk up some eggs, you pour some of the hot stock into the egg, and then pour the egg back into the soup. And then that enriches the soup, and then you add lemon juice to it. And it's a typical Greek dish, usually done with chicken, but it's delicious with the turkey.
There's a Greek restaurant in town that has that on Fridays. My wife loves that lemon chicken.
Yeah.
Ooh.
Okay. And you can put rice in that if you've got some. Many people celebrate Thanksgiving using rice as a side dish as opposed to a bread stuffing. And you can add rice to that soup, and it's really good.
All right, we've hit the turkey pretty hard here, but we've had a lot of side dishes, and yeah. Here's the one that stumps me. I like cranberry sauce in limited doses, and then I end up with a bunch left over, and most of it, I'll be honest, I end up throwing away, and I hate that because, cranberries are healthy foods from Wisconsin.
Absolutely healthy food, and what you need to do is bring it to my house because my son James eats it by the bowlful, just straight.
Straight
it's
cranberry.
His favorite part of Thanksgiving. He looks forward to that all year long. But for those of us who think it needs a little tempering, my favorite use of leftover cranberry sauce is parfaits. It makes a great morning breakfast. Yogurt parfait with cranberries, a little bit of granola, or a dessert with ice cream.
Uh-huh.
I think that's a delicious use of the cranberries.
Wow. Or whipped cream on top?
Oh, anything's good with
layers.
Whipped cream.
Whipped cream. Okay.
Right. Or a cranberry trifle. Now that you said whipped cream, I just thought of that. I've done that in the past, too. Lady fingers, whipped cream, cranberry sauce.
Wow. Okay. I like this. You're opening my mind. Opening me up to the cranberry sauce. I won't turn away the leftovers from the family anymore. Mashed potatoes. Now, there's one. I'm happy to just eat the mashed potatoes as they are.
Yeah.
One thing I'll do, though, with leftover mashed potatoes is they never hold together very well, but I try to make a mashed potato patty.
Yeah.
Leeks. I'll saute up some leeks, mush them up with the mashed potatoes, a little egg, maybe a little flour. And
perfect.
They're not really potato pancakes exactly.
No, I call those smashed potatoes.
Okay.
I take my mashed potatoes and cook them up like a hashed.
Okay. And, yeah. And what else, though, with mashed potatoes?
I have a lot of ideas for the mashed potatoes. So
all
we're
right.
going to hit on my favorite leftover dinner. And I make way too much stuff so that I can keep going and going and going all week long. So I like to make shepherd's pie.
Okay. I've had that. I've never made it, though.
It's really easy. And again, you've got all the components basically just sitting there. You're going to take whatever vegetables you have on hand. Maybe you have some frozen peas in the freezer, whatever, carrots, squash, whatever you have. Maybe your green bean casserole. And put that down in the bottom of a casserole dish. Then I take some onions and garlic, saute that up with the chopped turkey. And then I like to make a sauce with tomato paste, stock, and a few shots of Worcestershire sauce.
Okay.
Simmer that up and make a nice sauce. Put that as the next layer on top of the vegetables. Then you take your mashed potatoes, fold some grated cheddar cheese into it. Put that as the third layer. Bake that whole thing off till it's brown and bubbly. It is delightful.
And that's just in a casserole dish.
Just
there's
a casserole
no crust
dish.
Involved in a shepherd's
no.
pie, right?
No.
Okay.
It's
I get
much
it mixed
easier.
Up with pot pies, I guess.
Yeah. Yeah.
Similar
and
concept.
Then, yeah. Some more things you can do with your mashed potatoes is make dumplings. You could make a turkey dumpling soup. So you just add some flour to your potatoes and put them in and let those cook.
So you just drop them in as the soup's boiling?
Yeah.
Okay.
Exactly.
And they hold together. They don't just smoosh out. And
yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Right. I mean, you have to get the right amount of flour in there. And without knowing how liquidy your potatoes are, it's hard to say. But you want to get the good consistency from the flour, which also another idea is to add flour and make gnocchi. A little bit of Parmesan cheese. Boil those and then put a little bit of brown butter with sage, and that's a delicious, very different than your typical Thanksgiving meal.
Right. I've had gnocchi. That's like an Italian potato pasta.
Yeah, exactly.
I love it. Again, long list of things I like but have never tried to make.
Right.
And it sounds easier than I would imagine.
You know, it's all about the right touch.
Okay.
I've made some pretty bad gnocchi in my day, but I've also occasionally done it just right, and it's just getting the right texture.
Okay, here's another throwaway, the yams. I like a little bit of the sweet Thanksgiving yams.
But then what?
That wears thin.
Yeah. I've actually, I find them too sweet and to really use very easily in leftovers. But the one thing I came up with that I thought really worked well is tempering the sweet with heat and taking candy jams or maybe maple whipped sweet potatoes and just adding enough stock to turn it into a soup and then adding chipotle and adobo sauce so that you get a little sweet and a little heat and it balances out really nicely.
All right. Here's a puzzling question from our producer, Galen. Is there anything to do with leftover pies? My strategy is to cut a piece, put it on a plate, and then eat it. He's wondering if we can deep fry it, though, or do something wacky with it.
I think you can deep fry it. I actually haven't tried that. We don't seem to have very much trouble with leftover pie at my house. I almost never succeed in eating it the day of, and so I like it for breakfast the day after.
Okay. 30 seconds or so left. Any favorite things that we haven't gotten to for the Thanksgiving leftovers?
So I think a really fun thing to think about is all those leftover stuffings.
Oh, yeah, the stuffing.
And you can have a little appetizer party where you stuff some mushrooms and you can deep fry your stuffing as a ball. You can stuff pork chops if you're tired of your
turkey.
Or stuff a meatloaf. So there's a lot of ways to use up the stuffing that's not just reheating it.
Just stuff it with other stuff.
Yeah.
Patricia, thank you so much for joining us again.
Thank you very much. It was fun.
That's Patricia Mulvey, founder and chef at Local Time. They give advice on what to do with food from the community-supported agriculture programs a lot of people subscribe to around the state. Coming up Monday on Central Time, it's World AIDS Day this weekend. We'll focus on efforts to prevent and treat HIV infection for children and for teens. We'll hear from a guest who says the United States is going too far in militarizing its borders, and that's having an impact far beyond those borders. And what's unique about humans compared to all the other animals on the planet? Our guest will tell us about the gap between us and our animal cousins. That's all coming up, and a check of the news Monday on Central Time. Still to come today on Central Time, our guest says our future would be brighter if mayors ruled the world. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Veronica Rickert will be back on Monday. Coming up later in the program, consumer borrowing is slowly creeping up again, and as we head into the holiday season, we'll find out what this can mean for the credit of the average American. But first, it's time for Wisconsin Life. Lutefisk, cod that's been preserved in lye, is a Scandinavian delicacy. It's a polarizing dish, to say the least. Some people grow up loving it. Others despise it. That doesn't stop people from packing into the basement of the Christ Lutheran Church in DeForest every year. For months, volunteers plan the dinner and cook everything from scratch, including 1,900 pounds of lutefisk. WPR's Maureen McCollum went to see what brings people back year after year.
Fish, please.
Yeah, I'm Dan Paulson with Christ Lutheran Church, and I'm one of the co-chairpersons of the lutefisk dinner. And how long have we been involved? Jan, we have been involved since about, 1975.
I'm Jan Schultz, live in DeForest. 38 years ago was the first dinner.
What it is, it's a cod or a whitefish, and then they dehydrate it and preserve that in lye, and then it has to be rehydrated and wash all the lye out.
When they were immigrating, when they came to this country from Norway, they preserved it and they could put it in their suitcases. It was dry, they could bring it here.
At Christmas, my father was 100% Norwegian, my mother 100% German, so I'm just confused. But at Christmas, we had the lutefisk dinner. My father on my left, my uncle on my right. They passed that dish back and forth between the two of them, and I couldn't stand the smell. And finally, when they killed all the taste buds in my mouth, then I started loving it. So it's an acquired taste. But my sons, they love it right off the bat. Here's some more of the cooks. You can see the kettles of boiling water. So the boiling water drains off, and then we drop it into a dish, and that's where we separate the bones from the meat itself.
Yeah, once you get to be a bone picker, you never get rid of this job.
My name is Janice Tipple, and I live in the town of Windsor.
Janice, you said you became a member of Christ Lutheran. For what reason?
Because of the lutefisk dinner.
Really?
I did! Yes! We've been coming to this lutefisk dinner long before we became members. And it was the best lutefisk dinner, and we decided, well, we need to become members of this church.
That's one way to pick a church.
Today we have a lutefisk and Swedish meatballs with gravy, mashed potatoes, rutabagas, a delicious coleslaw, and lefse, and a melted butter, of course. Plenty of it. Matt Erlinson in Madison.
Wendy Bunster, Antigo, Wisconsin. This is a generational type of thing. Our grandparents, great-grandparents. We were raised having lutefisk lefse for Christmas dinner. The smell one can never forget. It's not good. It has to do with the lye flavor.
Ask him, he travels to all of them, practically.
They asked me how I found the lutefisk, and I said there was a truck went by, and we just followed our nose. My name is Dale, and my last name is Erlinson, and I live in Antigo. My nickname is Swede. That might have something to do with the fact that I like lutefisk. Well, mostly because it's a good fish. Because they cooked the lutefisk just perfect.
Our patriarchs here have been eating lutefisk since they could crawl, and it wasn't our favorite as children, but it's really grown on us, and now it's a great tradition.
Wisconsin Life is produced by Erica Janik. This episode was produced in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. You can find more info at wisconsinlife.org. This is Central Time. It's no secret that a lot of the world's governments are struggling in some ways. From partisan gridlock to bureaucratic dysfunction, serious problems are being left on the table. It seems sometimes like world leaders can't get anything done about them. Our next guest says there's a solution. The leaders of our cities are the perfect candidates, he says, to solve the world's most pressing problems, and they've got a track record of getting things done. Joining us now is Benjamin Barber. He's a research scholar at the City University of New York. He's the author of If Mayors Ruled the World, Dysfunctional Nations, Rising Cities. Benjamin, welcome to Central Time.
Nice to be with you in Central Time.
Your book, If Mayors Ruled the World, you say actually some of what you're looking for is already happening. A lot of mayors are taking on a leadership role that doesn't stop at their borders. Can you talk about how the role of mayor has changed recently?
Well, what's happened, just a quick little background here for your listeners, because it's really important to understand that for 400 or 500 years, the nation state has been the central instrument of our policies, how we govern ourselves, the center of democracy, and these independent, bordered, sovereign states are the center of popular sovereignty, the basis for the League of Nations, the Concert of Nations, the United Nations, all of the world, financial organizations like the World Bank and the WTO, they're all based on nation states. So we've lived for really 500 years in a world of nation states, and kids who take political science or civics all learn about American government or French government or Japanese government. So, you know, I'm really making a fairly bold and audacious claim by saying it's time to change the subject and stop talking about nation states. And there are two reasons I'm suggesting that. One is because states have become so extraordinarily dysfunctional, not just in the immediate sense of Washington, you know, closing down or Italy having a corrupt prime minister for so long, or Greek government not really functioning in the face of austerity, but in a deeper sense, because nation states defined by sovereignty and independence simply aren't very good at dealing with the 21st century world of interdependence. All the problems we face, think about it, are cross-border problems. Ecological change, climate change, that's a global problem. It's global warming. It's not Milwaukee warming that we face. World Wide Web, the technology is worldwide. Markets are worldwide. Terrorism is worldwide. Immigration is a worldwide problem. The new pandemics are not, you know, you don't worry about flu in Madison, Wisconsin. You worry about the Mexican pig virus or the West Nile virus or Hong Kong flu. Almost every problem we face in the 21st century is an interdependent cross-border problem. And here we are with 17th century nation-state institutions that deal exclusively with problems inside their own borders. And that's just a deep misfit to the challenges of the time. And what I'm arguing in the book is that if we change the subject, if we stop focusing on nation-states and begin thinking again about cities, where civilization and democracy began a millennia ago, in fact, we find that cities are confronting not just their own problems, but working together global problems, that cities are doing what nation states can't and don't, that mayors as pragmatists are solving problems that seem to defeat prime ministers and presidents.
And that's part of your argument, that mayors can't really be so ideological, they can't be so partisan, they have to make sure the garbage is collected, the traffic runs, and that problems get solved on a daily basis. Do you think that's part of what gives them a better seat to solve the problems you're talking about?
It is. You know, we just, a month or so ago, we watched the government in Washington, D.C. close down. I mean, America, the United States of America, kind of closed its government. Now, that was extraordinary for two reasons, that it happened at all, but it was also extraordinary because life went on. Some people were hurt by it, some people suffered, but for the most part, life went on. As Mayor Nutter said a couple of years ago in Philadelphia, the mayor of Philadelphia, he said, we could never get away with the crap here in Philadelphia that they do in Washington. We can't close Philadelphia. I mean, think about it. Think about closing Milwaukee or closing Detroit or closing New York. You can't close a city. That would mean what? No schools, no hospitals, no subways, no buses, no taxis, no firemen, no police. You just can't do it. Cities are the warp and woof of politics. They're where the rubber hits the road. They're where real problems are confronted. And that's why mayors can't afford to be ideologues. They can't stand on principle. They can't say, well, we'll just wait for a year and see whether the hospitals are going to have public unions or not, and meanwhile, we'll just close the hospitals. You know, you can't do that. You got to make things work. So mayors everywhere tend to be much more pragmatic. Many of them don't even identify with party government. We know Mayor Bloomberg in New York started as a Democrat, then he was a Republican, became an independent, and in the end just doesn't talk about it, because party really isn't very important when it comes to keeping the buses running, keeping the hospitals open, picking up the garbage, getting the snow plowed, and so forth. Those are practical problems, and mayors are above all pragmatists. They know how to solve problems. They know how to make things work, and that's actually what we want from our politicians.
But as you write in your book, a lot of people are suspicious of cities. They think of cities and they think of words like dysfunctional, crime. They look at places like Detroit filing bankruptcy, the high murder rate in Chicago. And that's, we're just talking cities in the United States there. Do cities function that well? Do mayors work that well that we should be looking to them for leadership?
Well, two things. You know, I learned a long time ago the relevant question is always as compared to what? So, you know, are cities corrupt? Are their mayors sometimes out of control, like our friend Rob Ford up in Toronto? Do they have problems? Do they have crime and so on? Of course they do. You know, the human frailty, human vice doesn't stop at City Hall. Cities have as much as anywhere else. But the question is, how do they function in dealing with all the challenges of corruption and crime and so on that they face? And the record is everywhere, not just in the United States, but around the world, that in fact they have a much better record. They have to really have that record of dealing realistically with problems. I mean, let's take immigration, for example. You look at the politicians in Washington who have been screwing around for years without getting a new immigration policy passed. And in effect, they're saying, well, therefore, anyone who comes into America without a visa, without a pass, is here illegally, and in effect, for all practical legal purposes of United States jurisdiction, they don't exist. Then you take the mayor of Milwaukee, you take the mayor of Chicago, or the mayor of New York, and say, well, now what are we going to do about the reality that maybe they don't exist to the federal government, but in the United States there are 12 million undocumented workers who are here, and their kids are here, and they're in our cities. Do we not allow them in the hospitals, or do we? Do we not allow them in the schools, or do we? Do we try to register them so we can follow them in terms of crime and drugs and so forth? Do we permit them to have jobs? Do we even give them a driver's license at the state level in order to make sure that they're legal and they can be tracked? The reality of mayors is you have to deal with the reality of immigrants. National politicians can sit there and posture and grandstand about whether they think immigrants should be here or not, but the reality is they are here, and it's in cities and with mayors that you have to deal, first of all, with reality. I know of no mayor, whether it's Hamburg, Germany, or Seoul, Korea, Los Angeles, Mayor Garcetti, the new mayor of Los Angeles, who isn't confronted with the problem of not should they be here, but how do we deal with them since, in fact, they are here.
We're talking with Benjamin Barber. He's making the case that mayors should take a leadership role in solving many of the world's problems. His new book is If Mayors Ruled the World. What do you think about the ideas you're hearing? Do you think big city mayors, big city leaders, should take a leadership role in solving things like climate change, poverty, disease, and more? Give a call, 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email talk@wpr.org. We'll pick up the conversation with a look at the idea of a world parliament of mayors. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation now with Benjamin Barber about the role mayors, he says, should play in the national and international political scene. You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. His new book is If Mayors Ruled the World. One of your audacious suggestions is the idea of a global parliament of mayors. What would that look like?
Well, we had a League of Nations, never worked very well. We've had a United Nations, it should better be called the Disunited Nations, you know, with vetoes in the Security Council to prevent it from ever really acting on security issues, and a talkathon General Assembly that is so divided and so on that nothing happens. So although it's got some good agencies to try to do a little good work, the fact is the United Nations doesn't work either. We have no global governance to take on the global problems of climate change, of global pandemics, of crime and drugs and terrorism that we face. And it's not just I'm suggesting that mayors could and should convene in a parliament. There are already dozens of international and intercity associations most people have never heard of. There's an organization called United Cities and Local Governments, UCLG. I call it the most important organization in the world nobody's ever heard of because it's got 3,000 or 4,000 cities in it. They meet every year. They examine best practices. They share what they're doing, and they create cooperative associations together. An organization like ICLE, the International Environmental Concerns of Local Government, and the C40, an organization started by Mayor Bloomberg and Bill Clinton and a bunch of other mayors, including the mayor of Toronto back then, Miller, is an organization that works among cities to develop climate change proposals, greening up a port, insulating city buildings, bike share programs, pedestrian programs, above ground rapid transit bus lanes with dedicated lanes where other cars and so on can't go in them. And those are all ideas that have been developed through cities cooperating together, and they've had a profound impact on, for example, climate change. 80% of carbon emissions come from cities, which means that whether or not states want to act, and as we've seen since Copenhagen, they don't and haven't, and most recently at Warsaw, they came home again having admitted they could do nothing, but cities are acting. And the port of Los Angeles was cleaned up by Mayor Villaraigosa, and about half of the port emissions ceased, since 40% of LA's port city emissions come from the port. That was about a fifth of the carbon emissions of L.A. that the mayor cured. So cities are meeting together and can. My proposal for a global parliament is to put a kind of keystone in the arch of intercity associations that already exist, the literally dozens and dozens of city networks around the world where cities cooperate, but a parliament of mayors constituted by cities around the world would allow that convening of important city politicians and councilmen and representing their citizens to have a genuine impact on global public opinion, to share their best practices and work together to address the problems that nation states have proven they really are not very good at addressing anymore.
You know, it seems like the strength of a mayor is that they're there. They're connected to their local community. When they go and meet, does a mayor of New York and a mayor of Mumbai and Seoul and Rio de Janeiro, do they really have that much in common where they can share these ideas in a meaningful way?
Well, that's a great question, because we think from the point of view of cultural differences and geographical differences, you know, cities are very different. It's true. There's some, you know, Wisconsin and Kansas have a lot of towns between, say, 5,000 and 50,000 or 100,000. And then there are places like Germany or France that have much larger cities. And then we have these mega cities of 20 or 30 million in Latin America and in Africa. So cities are very different. But here's the reality, and here's what mayors discover when they meet together. Urban transport, whether you build for billions of dollars an underground subway or for 5% of that cost a rapid transit system above ground, the idea of bike share programs that make bikes available to the public and introduce bicycles into places that never had them, these are ideas that work on every continent around the world and have been shared. Every single mayor faces the problem of local crime, of drugs, of illegal immigration, of pickup of garbage and how you do that. In other words, urban problems are common despite the great diversity of cities across the world. And when mayors meet, they very quickly discover they have the same problems, and they can often share not identical solutions, but share approaches that fit their particular challenges and their particular size and so on. So the reality has been, and this is why, as I say, I'm not saying let's for the first time have mayors meet. Mayors have been meeting and meet a lot all the time, and all I'm suggesting is that we maybe put a keystone in the arch of these organizations by having a parliament of mayors that, like the United Nations, but for cities, allows them to share at the highest level their practices and to opt into common practices that work around the world and provide an alternative voice to the disunited nations and the contentious nation states and the rival nations that set peoples against one another. I mean, the other reality is that nation states are monocultural. You know, they're Japanese, they're French, they're English, they're German. Cities are multicultural, they're diverse, and they reflect the diversity of the world, and that's true of cities everywhere.
One challenge I would see is that the cities, in some ways, their hands are tied in the United States, maybe by the state government or by a federal, a national government elsewhere. Do they really have that much latitude of action?
Well, you're right, and that's a great point, and one of the great challenges that, you know, we need to take on is the challenge of cities subsidiary to provinces and national states, where they don't have the freedom, the autonomy, the jurisdiction, and the resources to meet the problems that they're capable of meeting. But remember something. Cities generate 80% of GDP. They're responsible in almost every country in the world for the majority of taxes. The problem is they don't get back the resources they create. You know, we've seen the Tea Party argue that lazy welfare people in the city are spending their taxes that are taxed in the rural regions. The reality is just the opposite. Cities contribute far more to the rural regions and to the country at large than the rural regions of the city and the country contribute back to cities. This has been the problem also of jurisdiction. You talked about Detroit earlier. You know, Detroit is bankrupt, but the Detroit that's bankrupt is the 19th century Detroit, the very narrow 19th century boundaries. While that narrow Detroit went from 2 million to 700,000 in the last 20 years, the 10 counties around Detroit that make up the greater Detroit metropolitan region went from 3 to 5 million and have become the number 4 new economy zone in the United States and are doing extremely well. And if the greater Detroit metropolitan region was identical with the actual Detroit city limits where they tax and so on and have all those problems, you'd see a much more successful form of governance. And that's true in many parts of America. When you're talking about cities, you're talking about metropolitan regions, and the metropolitan regions are what succeed. But as you said in your question, right now we're organized so that cities are defined narrowly, their resources are largely taken away from them, and they don't have the wherewithal to do the things that they're capable of doing. And that has to become a political battle. We need an urban party that will fight for the rights of cities, the jurisdiction of cities, and the autonomy of cities, relatively speaking, to do the things they can do. And that's, again, where cities working together and citizens cooperating with the other citizens can make a big difference. If Milwaukee cooperates with Detroit and Cleveland and Louisville and other citizens and Chicago and so on, I bet they will find they're in a position to begin to increase their autonomy and jurisdictional authority within Illinois and Wisconsin and Kentucky and Ohio in ways that will be useful to the majority. Remember, the majority of people in the world live in cities, 75% of Americans live in cities, and yet cities don't really exercise majority control. And in a real democratic majority, majoritarian system, cities ought to, in fact, have the right to govern themselves.
And that's part of your vision here, not just that cities cooperate and share ideas, but that they unionize, sort of, to pull their political muscle to bear?
That's exactly right. And I think of an urban, we have Democrats and Republicans and Tories and socialists and liberals and conservatives. But what we need is an urban party, a party that brings together the more than half of the world's population that live in cities to represent urban common interests, urban public interests that turn out to be universal interests. One of the reasons people in cities fight very hard to control climate change is that people in cities, as New Orleans and New York, you know, have learned, are the first to suffer. 90% of the world's cities are on water, lakes, rivers, or oceans. And it's people who live in cities who, first of all, will deal with the consequences of ocean rise. So, yes, cities have a great deal in common, and there should be a common urban party fighting for the rights of urban people. And that kind of a party in the United States, I think, would be far more successful than a Democratic or a Republican party.
We'll leave it there, Benjamin. Thank you so much for joining us today. Appreciate
thanks
it.
Thanks a lot. Sorry to talk so much.
That's okay. Benjamin Barber is the author of If Mayors Ruled the World, Dysfunctional Nations, Rising Cities. Coming up after the news, we'll look at the debt facing many Americans and what it means during this holiday season. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time here in the Ideas Network.